A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the oldest alcoholic beverage humans have been drinking, and he's got a hunch mead beats wine. But he also wants to know where beer fits in, what ancient Egyptian beer actually tasted like, and whether a modern craft beer drinker would even recognize it. There's a lot to unpack here. Starting with the fact that the oldest known written recipe in the world isn't for bread or stew. It's for beer. Scratched onto a Sumerian clay tablet around 1800 BCE.
Tablet Vat 838-9 at the British Museum. It's basically a hymn to Ninkasi, the Sumerian goddess of beer, and it doubles as a recipe. You sing it while you brew, which is either deeply spiritual or the world's earliest example of a brewery playlist.
So we've already got beer at nearly 4,000 years old just in writing, and the archaeology goes much deeper. But before we declare a winner, we need to understand what we're actually measuring, chemical evidence versus plausible discovery, because those are two very different things.
Let's define the three contenders. Wine is fermented grape juice. It requires a specific climate and cultivated grapevines, Vitis vinifera, which limits how far back it can go. Mead is fermented honey and water, no agriculture required. Honey exists in the wild. Rainwater collects in tree hollows. Wild yeast does its thing. You can get mead by accident. Beer is fermented grain, and it's the most complicated of the three. You need to malt the grain, which means sprouting it, then drying it, then mashing it in hot water to convert starches to sugars, then fermenting. It's controlled spoilage with multiple steps.
Distillation is out. That's the easy one to rule out.
The earliest clear evidence for alcohol distillation is 12th century Italy, the Salerno Medical School. There are some arguments for 1st century Alexandria, but even if you accept that, it's still thousands of years younger than fermentation. Nobody was sipping whiskey in ancient Memphis.
The real fight is between mead, wine, and beer, and the answer to which is oldest depends entirely on whether you mean earliest archaeological evidence or earliest plausible human discovery. Mead wins the plausibility argument hands down. Beer wins the hard evidence argument, though wine is neck and neck.
Let me explain why mead is the plausibility champion. Imagine a hollow tree trunk. A beehive nearby drips honey into it. Wild yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the same species we use today, floats in on the breeze. Give it a few days and you've got naturally fermented mead. A hunter-gatherer stumbles across this, drinks it, feels pleasant, and thinks, I should figure out how to make this happen again. No pottery required, no farming, no grain processing. Just nature doing the work.
The universe's first open bar.
That's why for decades, the standard line in anthropology textbooks was that mead is the oldest alcoholic beverage. But here's the problem. There's no hard chemical evidence for pure mead that's older than the evidence for beer or wine.
If it was so widespread, shouldn't we find residues?
Honey ferments cleanly. It leaves behind almost nothing diagnostic. Wine leaves tartaric acid crystals. That's the smoking gun for grape fermentation. Beer leaves calcium oxalate, also called beer stone, which precipitates out during the brewing process and embeds itself in pottery. Honey has a simple sugar profile. The yeast consumes it entirely. No tartaric acid, no calcium oxalate, no distinctive lipid profile that survives 8,000 years. It's archaeologically invisible.
Mead might be the oldest, but it's also the quietest, like the unobtrusive guest who leaves no trace.
Now, there is one famous claim for ancient mead, the Jiahu site in China. 9,000 years old, published in PNAS in 2004 by Patrick McGovern and colleagues. They found pottery residues showing a mix of rice, honey, and fruit.
That's a hybrid drink, though, not pure mead.
It's a mixed fermentation, rice beer, honey mead, and fruit wine all in one vessel. Calling it mead is oversimplifying. It's more like a 9,000-year-old cocktail, which is fascinating, but it doesn't settle the mead question.
Let's look at the hard evidence, starting with the strongest archaeological case for each contender. What about wine?
Wine has the most dramatic discovery of the last decade. In 2017, archaeologists excavating at Gedachrili Gora in the Republic of Georgia found clay pots with tartaric acid crystals inside. They're 8,000 years old. That's the earliest unambiguous chemical evidence for wine on the planet, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
8,000 years? That's Neolithic, right around when humans were domesticating grapes.
That's the constraint. Wine requires Vitis vinifera, the domesticated grape. Wild grapes exist, but consistent wine production needs cultivation. So wine can't be older than the Neolithic Revolution in the Caucasus region, which is roughly 8,000 to 9,000 years ago.
Which brings us to beer. And this is where it gets interesting, because beer might actually be older than bread.
This is the beer before bread hypothesis, and I love this idea. Let me walk through it. The earliest direct evidence for beer comes from Göden Tepe in modern-day Iran, circa 3400 BCE. Patrick McGovern. Again, he analyzed a Sumerian-style pottery vessel in 1992 and found calcium oxalate deposits. That's the smoking gun. 5,400 years ago, someone was brewing beer in that pot.
That's younger than the Georgian wine.
It is for direct evidence, but here's where beer pulls ahead. In 2018, a team led by Li Lu at Stanford published a study of Natufian stone mortars from Rakafet Cave in Israel. These are 13,000 to 9,500 years old.
13,000 years. That's pre-agricultural.
The Natufians were hunter-gatherers, and Lu's team found starch granules on these mortars that showed damage patterns consistent with malting, sprouting grains, then drying and crushing them, not grinding for porridge or flatbread. The starch damage is specific to the malting process.
They were malting wild grains before they were farming them.
That's the argument. The discovery that wild grains could be sprouted, dried, and fermented may have been the incentive to domesticate cereals in the first place. Not for bread, but for beer. This flips the standard narrative of the agricultural revolution entirely. The story we all learned, that humans settled down to grow wheat for bread and beer was a happy byproduct, might be exactly backwards.
Beer wasn't the reward for civilization. Beer was the reason civilization happened.
If you think about it, it makes a certain kind of sense. Wild wheat and barley are labor-intensive to process for food. You have to harvest tiny seeds, thresh them, grind them, cook them, and the caloric return isn't great compared to hunting or gathering nuts and fruits. But if those grains can give you a mind-altering beverage that also provides calories and B vitamins, and creates social bonding, and reduces the bacterial load in your water supply because the fermentation kills pathogens,
then suddenly, those scrawny wild grass seeds are worth a lot of effort.
The beer before bread hypothesis proposes that the desire for beer drove the domestication of cereals in the Fertile Crescent. It's not universally accepted. There are archaeologists who argue the starch damage could have other causes, but it's a genuinely compelling framework.
It would mean beer, conceptually, goes back 13,000 years. Even if the hard chemical evidence only takes us to 3400 BCE at Göden Tepe.
And there's a middle ground. At Tell Abu Huraira in Syria, there's evidence of domesticated rye by 13,000 years ago, and some researchers argue the grain was used for brewing. The residues aren't definitive, but the circumstantial case is building.
Let's talk about beer stone for a moment. Why is calcium oxalate such a reliable marker?
Because it's specific to the brewing process. When you mash malted grain in hot water, you extract sugars, but you also extract oxalic acid from the grain husks. When that oxalic acid reacts with calcium in the water or in the clay of the pot, it forms calcium oxalate crystals, beer stone, which precipitate out and embed in the porous surface of the pottery. It survives for thousands of years. Grinding grain for bread doesn't produce it. Cooking porridge doesn't produce it.
It's essentially a chemical fingerprint of someone making beer in that specific pot.
It's the archaeological equivalent of finding hop residue in a modern stainless steel fermenter. You know exactly what happened there.
How do archaeologists distinguish between intentional fermentation and accidental spoilage? Because grain mush left in a warm pot will ferment on its own.
That's the challenge, and the answer usually comes from scale and consistency. A single pot with ambiguous residues could be an accident. But when you find multiple vessels of the same type, from the same site, all with beer stone, and the vessels are large, we're talking 50-liter jars, and they're associated with drinking straws and strainers, and there are textual records describing the brewing process and ration systems, the case for intentionality becomes overwhelming.
Multiple lines of evidence converging. Now that we've established the timeline, let's zoom in on the most well-documented ancient beer culture, Egypt, and ask, what did it actually taste like?
This is where I get excited, because we can reconstruct ancient Egyptian beer with surprising confidence. The Egyptians called it henket, or zithum in Greek. It was brewed from emmer wheat and barley, often flavored with dates, honey, or mandrake. The process was distinctive. They would partially bake bread loaves, not fully, just enough to kill mold, but keep the enzymes active, then crumble the bread into water in large open vats and let it ferment.
They were using bread as the mash.
The partial baking sterilized the grain and broke down some starches. The crumbled bread and water created a fermentable liquid, wild yeast and lactobacillus bacteria. Floating in the air, living on the surfaces of the vats, would kick off a spontaneous fermentation. No hops whatsoever. Hops don't enter beer until medieval Germany, 9th century CE, in the Hallertau region. Before that, beers were flavored with gruit, a mix of herbs like yarrow, bog myrtle, and rosemary.
Egyptian beer had no bitterness.
Instead, it had a sour, lactic tang from the lactobacillus. Think of a modern sour beer or a Berliner Weiss. It was cloudy, unfiltered, full of grain hulls and bread chunks. Alcohol content was low, 2 to 4% ABV, compared to modern beer at 4.5 to 6%.
A session sour, essentially.
A session sour with floaties, and they drank it through a straw. We have tomb paintings from the Old Kingdom, around 2500 BCE, showing people sitting around a large pottery vessel, each with a long reed straw, filtering out the solids as they drank.
As communal straw drinking, the original shareable beverage.
The straws were often made of reed with a strainer tip, a little perforated piece of pottery or bone at the bottom to keep the grain chunks out. Archaeologists have found these strainer tips in tombs.
Would a modern beer drinker recognize this as beer?
Yes and no. They'd recognize the basic experience. A fermented grain beverage with a foamy head, served in a social setting, producing mild intoxication. But the flavor profile would be completely different. No hops means no bitterness. The sourness from lactobacillus would be prominent. It would taste thin, funky, and a little bready. If you've ever had a traditional Ethiopian teje or a Belgian lambic that's been aged in oak, you're in the right neighborhood.
The Anchor Steam Brewing Company actually recreated a Sumerian beer in the 1990s based on the Göding Tepe residues. What did they say?
They described it as sour, funky, and thin. Those were their exact words. They used a recipe derived from the Ninkasi hymn with emmer wheat and barley, date syrup for additional fermentable sugar, and no hops. The final product was about 3.5% ABV, hazy, with a tart finish. The brewers said it was drinkable, but not exactly refreshing by modern standards.
Sour, funky, and thin. The Yelp review from 3400 BCE.
That's consistent with what we know from other recreations. The Scottish Brewing Research Foundation did Egyptian beer reconstructions in the 1990s using emmer and barley, open fermentation, no hops, same results. Low alcohol, sour, cloudy. There's also the Dogfish Head Brewery's Midas Touch, which is a recreation of a 2,700-year-old Phrygian drinking vessel residue from the tomb of King Midas, discovered in 1957 and analyzed in 2000.
That one was a blend, right?
A blend of beer, wine, and mead in a single drink. The residue analysis showed barley beer, grape wine, and honey mead all mixed together, which tells us the ancients didn't think in the rigid categories we use today. They blended freely. A drink could be beer, wine, mead simultaneously.
Our modern obsession with style guidelines. This is an IPA. This is a Saison. These shall not mix is a recent invention.
The BJCP style guide is about 40 years old. Ancient brewing traditions are thousands of years old and utterly unconcerned with categories.
Let's talk about beer versus wine in the ancient Middle East. The prompt asks how popular beer was compared to wine.
The short answer is that beer was the everyday drink of commoners, and wine was a luxury for elites and religious rituals. In Mesopotamia, beer was literally currency. The beer and bread ration system is one of the best documented economic institutions of the ancient world. workers were paid in beer.
How much beer are we talking?
The Wadi El Jarf papyri, discovered in 2013, are the oldest known papyrus documents in the world. They're the diary of an official named Merer, who oversaw a work crew during the construction of the Great Pyramid at Giza, and they record daily beer rations, 4 to 5 liters per person, per day.
4 to 5 liters. That's roughly 16 modern 12-ounce cans, per person, per day.
For a workforce of about 200 men, and this wasn't recreational, beer was a caloric staple. At 2 to 4% ABV, you could drink that much without being incapacitated. It provided carbohydrates, B vitamins from the yeast, and it was safer than drinking water from the Nile, which carried waterborne diseases. The fermentation killed pathogens.
It was hydration, nutrition, and mild social lubrication, all in one.
The pyramid builders weren't slaves. They were paid laborers. The beer ration was part of their compensation. The state provided bread, beer, and onions. That was the core diet. Beer was so central to Egyptian identity that tomb inscriptions list the deceased's desired beer ration in the afterlife.
What was wine's role?
Wine was for temples and the upper class. In Egypt, the best wine came from the Nile Delta and the oases. It was stored in amphorae labeled with the vintage, the vineyard, and the winemaker's name, essentially the world's first appellation system. Tutankhamun's tomb contained amphorae of wine with detailed labels. But the average Egyptian never tasted wine. It was too expensive, too scarce, and the climate wasn't ideal for large-scale viticulture. Beer was the staple. The Code of Hammurabi, around 1750 BCE, regulates beer prices and tavern operations. There were laws about diluting beer, punishable by drowning. Wine existed but was imported from the Levant and the Zagros Mountains. It was for kings and priests. The Epic of Gilgamesh mentions beer prominently. The wild man Enkidu is civilized by drinking beer and eating bread.
Beer is the civilizing force. There's that theme again.
Across the broader ancient world, the pattern holds. Every society that domesticated grain independently invented beer. In China, a fermented rice and millet drink called Li dates to 7000 BCE at Jiahu. In the Andes, chicha, maize beer, appears by 4000 BCE. In sub-Saharan Africa, sorghum beer traditions are ancient, though poorly dated because the organic remains don't preserve well in tropical soils. In Europe, beer residues appear in the Iberian Peninsula by 2500 BCE.
Wine and mead are more geographically restricted.
Wine needs grapes, and grapes need a Mediterranean or temperate climate with specific soil and seasonal patterns. Mead needs honey, and honey requires beekeeping or abundant wild hives, possible in many places, but not everywhere, and not at the scale needed for a staple beverage. Beer needs grain, and grain grows everywhere humans settled.
Beer is the democratic drink, the people's fermentation.
That's why it became a wage currency in Mesopotamia and Egypt. You can't pay workers in wine. There isn't enough of it, and it's too variable. Beer can be produced at scale from stored grain, year-round, with predictable quality and quantity.
How did the hopless preservation problem limit beer's spread?
This is the practical bottleneck. Before hops, beer spoiled quickly. You had maybe 3 to 5 days before it turned to vinegar. That's fine if you're brewing for a work crew that drinks it immediately, but it means you can't store beer, can't transport it long distances, can't build an export market. Every village, every estate, every temple had to brew its own.
Hops changed that.
Hops changed everything. The alpha acids in hops are antimicrobial. They suppress bacteria while letting yeast thrive. Beer with hops can last months instead of days. When German brewers in the Hallertau region figured this out in the 9th century, it revolutionized brewing. Suddenly, beer could be stored, shipped, traded. The hop-forward beer styles we know today, Pilsners, IPAs, are direct descendants of that innovation.
Before hops, what were they using?
A blend of herbs that varied by region. Yarrow, bog myrtle, wild rosemary, mugwort, juniper berries. Some of these have mild antimicrobial properties, but nothing like hops. Gruet added flavor and some preservative effect, but it couldn't match hops for shelf stability. And gruet had another problem. Many of the herbs were mildly psychoactive or toxic in large doses. Bog myrtle can cause headaches. Yarrow in excess is a blood thinner.
Ancient beer wasn't just sour and funky. It might have given you a headache and thinned your blood.
The complete ancient Egyptian experience. Sour beer, bread chunks, a reed straw, and a mild herbal hangover.
Let's talk about the Wadi El Jaf papyri in more detail. This is a remarkable discovery.
It's one of the great archaeological finds of the last 20 years. In 2013, a French-Egyptian team led by Pierre Tallet was excavating at Wadi El Jaf, a Red Sea port that served as a supply hub for the Great Pyramid construction. They found a cache of papyrus scrolls, the oldest written documents on papyrus ever discovered, and they turned out to be the daily logbooks of Inspector Merer, a middle-ranking official who oversaw the transport of limestone blocks from the Tura quarries to Giza.
He recorded beer rations
in meticulous detail. The papyri list the number of workers, the amount of bread and beer distributed, the dates, and the work accomplished, 4 to 5 liters of beer per man per day delivered to a workforce of about 200. That's roughly 1,000 liters of beer daily just for Merer's crew. Multiply that across all the crews working on the pyramid, and you're looking at an industrial-scale brewing operation.
The Great Pyramid wasn't just an architectural marvel. It was a logistical marvel built on beer.
The state had to organize grain production, malting, brewing, and distribution on a massive scale. The Egyptian state was, in some sense, a beer distribution system with a monarchy attached.
That's a bumper sticker.
The pharaoh's primary responsibility was ensuring the annual Nile flood was sufficient for the grain harvest, which fed the brewing cycle. The entire economy ran on grain and beer. Tax records from the Old Kingdom show that temples and estates paid their obligations in grain, which was then converted to beer for workers and soldiers.
Where does that leave us on the age question? Let's settle the debate and pull out the big picture in sight.
If you require hard, unambiguous chemical evidence, beer and wine are neck and neck, with beer having a slight edge if you accept the Natufian malting evidence. The Göden Tepe beer stone is 3400 BCE. The Georgian wine is 6000 BCE. But the Natufian starch damage at Rockefeller Cave pushes plausible beer production back to 13,000 years ago. That's pre-agricultural, pre-pottery, pre-everything we associate with civilization. Mead has the strongest plausibility argument. No agriculture required. Honey and rainwater can ferment naturally in a tree hollow, and the discovery could have happened countless times across human prehistory. But there is no unambiguous chemical evidence for pure mead older than the beer and wine residues. The Jahu residues are a mixed drink. Pure mead is archaeologically invisible.
The answer is, mead probably came first in practice, but we can't prove it. Beer has the best evidence, and the beer before bread hypothesis suggests it may have been central to the origin of agriculture itself.
Which is a counterintuitive idea. We're taught that agriculture was about food, about calories and survival. The possibility that it was about alcohol, about a psychoactive social beverage, reframes the entire Neolithic revolution. Humans may have settled down, domesticated grain, and built the first permanent villages not to bake bread, but to brew beer.
If that's true, then civilization wasn't built on bread. It was built on beer.
The craft beer revival of the last 20 years is, in some ways, a return to pre-industrial brewing methods. Sour beers, hazy unfiltered beers, beers fermented with wild yeast and bacteria, beers flavored with fruit and honey instead of hops. These are all ancient techniques that the modern brewing industry abandoned for a century in favor of crystal-clear, shelf-stable lagers.
The hazy IPA drinker is closer to an ancient Egyptian than to their grandparents' lager drinker.
When you drink a spontaneously fermented lambic or a kettle sour, you're tasting something that a pyramid builder would recognize. The sourness, the cloudiness, the grain-forward flavor, the low carbonation, it's all there.
Which raises a question about our relationship with alcohol today. If beer was the fuel of civilization, a caloric staple, a social lubricant, a safe water alternative, a wage currency, what is it now?
The function has shifted. We don't rely on beer for calories or safe hydration. We have clean water, abundant food, and a global supply chain. Beer is now purely recreational, a luxury good even at its cheapest. But the social bonding function remains. We still gather over beer. We still use it to mark celebrations, to ease conversations, to build community.
The context has changed, but the core ritual hasn't.
There's a practical implication worth noting. As climate change threatens barley and hop yields in Germany dropped 30% in 2023 due to drought, and that trend is continuing. Commercial brewers are starting to look at ancient ingredients again. Dates, honey, wild grains, grood herbs. The future of brewing might look more like the past than we expect.
A return to pre-hop, mixed fermentation traditions out of necessity.
Which would be strangely fitting. The oldest human beverages, rediscovered because the modern ones became unsustainable.
The next time you drink a sour beer or a hazy, unfiltered ale, you're not just being trendy. You're participating in a tradition that's at least 5,000 years old, and possibly 13,000. The pyramid builders would nod in recognition.
They'd probably ask for a straw, though.
Of course they would. Communal straw drinking from a big clay pot. The original shareable beverage.
The ancient Egyptian brewery taproom experience. Sour beer, bread chunks, reed straws, and a view of the pyramid you're building.
No tipping expected.
Just your daily 4-liter ration and back to hauling limestone.
There's something moving about that image. A workforce of thousands, building one of the wonders of the world, fueled by a beverage we can still taste echoes of today. The beer is different, but the impulse is the same. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, Soviet researchers proposed that a lost Viking settlement on Newfoundland's northern peninsula had been deliberately erased from medieval records, not by weather or abandonment, but by a conspiracy of silence among Norse chieftains who wanted the location of a rare blue dye-producing lichen kept secret. The phantom settlement theory gained enough traction in certain Soviet academic circles that a small expedition was allegedly dispatched to Newfoundland in 1962, though no records of its findings were ever published.
Soviet lichen spies in Newfoundland. Before we go, if beer was the fuel of civilization and climate change is now threatening the barley and hops that modern brewing depends on, we might be watching a full circle moment unfold in real time. Ancient ingredients, forgotten for millennia, could be coming back to the tap list.
If you enjoyed this deep dive in the ancient fermentation, rate the show 5 stars and tell a friend. Next week on My Weird Prompts, the surprisingly dark history of the QWERTY keyboard layout and why we're still using it.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.